Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
So, we got some pretty exciting news. We got an email.
All right. Yeah. Hey, we get emails all the time.
We got another email.
That's what I was going for. I thought we were going to say that. Yeah.
This one kind of stood out.
Yeah. This is from Alpha Dean Lewis. So he writes, "Awesome podcast. I listened to you for the first time with your episode 51 on your thoughts on 5e. Pretty insightful on most accounts. I've been gaming for more than 30 years, and I have to say that D&D does have to and can reinvent itself. It can actually come across as an entirely different animal, but has to harken back to its old glory days if it truly wants to capture the imaginations of the next breed of gamer, as well as retain us old dogs. I say that to infer this. Core classes, if you will, and then build options. These would allow you to build any kind of combination of characters you see fit. For example, a core class would be warrior, arcane caster, specialist, divine caster, etc. Each core class comes built with the basics of what makes it core, and then you get option points to spend. Warrior options, arcane options, specialist options, etc. Buying options outside of your core would cost a greater number of points, but would give you the ability to make any kind of class you want. The next thing is to get rid of the Vancian spell system and replace it with a spell points. Psionics can also be fixed by making them powers, as in 4E, and then they function the same way at will, encounter, daily, and so forth. A la new D&D. I know I made this highly simplified, but I think you get the drift. So what do you think?
You know, I'm surprised he mentions getting rid of the Vancian spell system.
Yeah, it's very iconic D&D, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. Fire and forget.
So. Yeah. Yeah. So, he is suggesting spell points, which other systems use.
Mm-hmm. I like the one where the part where he says the core classes there, the warrior, the arcane caster, the specialist, and the divine caster. Actually, I thought that is something that is really good for a tabletop game, rather than kind of the combat divisions they've got now, where it's defender and damage striker.
It's leader, defender, striker, and controller.
Thank you very much. I think that's more kind of the way it is on multiplayer online games, because it's all about the combat roles. But I think that the ones he lists here as the core classes are more suited for role players. In that, like, I see some people, they want to have kind of the toolbox character can do different kinds of things, and that would be more like a wizard or a specialist like a rogue. And then you also have people who just kind of want to roll dice and say, I hit it, and that could be more a basic warrior.
Not to disagree with you, but I
disagree with you.
Yeah, I disagree with you. All right. Sorry. But I don't know, like the roles in 4E, I didn't mind them because they give you kind of something to latch onto, right?
Yeah.
And it helps to build a balanced party if you have all those covered, right? Mm. And I think within those, like even if you're like a controller,
yeah.
Granted, like they didn't really have the option in 4E, but you could be the specialist and be a controller, or you could be like, I don't know, like a leader and be, I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't see those things as being mutually exclusive, right?
I don't think that they are, but I don't think 4E did it very well. You had the kind of a set number of skills, so it's hard to build a skill monkey. I remember there was a quote once saying that 4E turned everyone into a wizard because everybody has an array of powers laid out in front of them and you choose among them. There isn't just kind of the standard go and attack.
Well, there was.
But nobody wanted to use it.
So just the roles he suggests here specifically, I think, are really good specifically for tabletop gaming. But yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, that's what third edition did in 3.5.
Yes.
I remember, you know, you buy the complete Divine, complete mm-hmm. Arcane.
Yeah. Complete adventure, complete
and
scoundrel,
I thought
yeah.
That was really.
Oh, I did like that. And then Alpha Dean here, gets into warrior options, arcane options, specialist options, divine options, but of course, you can buy outside your role.
Yeah.
Instant multiclass.
I like that. I understand what you're both saying, and I'm not going to disagree.
But I'm going to disagree.
What's in between agree and disagree? I don't know. We'll make up a new word in a moment.
Wayne?
It's
called Wayne.
I think with 4E, what they were doing is changing the vocabulary.
Mm.
So people from the video game media could come into a tabletop role-playing game and kind of understand what the roles
right.
are, whereas
yeah.
they might not understand the distinction between arcane and divine.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, warrior and specialist are pretty easy, and then there's two types of spellcasters. Yeah, and maybe controller is not very helpful either, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I think we're just trying to give them a vocabulary and And maybe I would say one step further for 5e is not necessarily try to mimic what the video game vocabulary or computer game vocabulary is, but try to create your own that's kind of very intuitive, like warrior, specialist, and what else? How do you distinguish between the arcane and the divine?
That's easy. Holy man, wizard.
Yeah, okay, so what does that mean? So one's a holy man, one's a wizard. So I would say, so one's just a priest, and and he can cast spells. Oh, he can cast spells. So what's the difference between his spells or her spells and a wizard's spells? You know, there's a lot of questions. And if you say, well, the divine spellcaster is very defensive and buffs and things like that. Whereas the arcane, it can be more offensive or more creative. I don't know, but is there another way we can describe those two types of spellcasters other than arcane and divine, which are more about the source as opposed to what it does?
Right, their role.
Yeah. Hey, could you explain what it does as opposed to where it comes from?
Hmm. Oh, I probably couldn't. I would have to think.
DPS and buffer.
But is even buffer, I mean, should 5e only try to, you know, appeal to the computer gamer? Like by using like buffs or whatever? I suppose that is also people in regular role playing. Right. But how about the completely uninitiated? Somebody that isn't interested in World of Warcraft and has never opened a D&D book before, and you say, he buffs people. What's that mean?
Well, that's us. How did they say it for us when we first started reading
World of Warcraft? Oh, we had to go look at a dictionary.
Yeah, probably.
Oh, but we had the time. We had Atari. And
yeah.
That's true, but kids nowadays
Commodore 64
have dictionaries and Wikipedia, so.
Yeah,
but they're too busy doing other things, so.
Yeah, as soon as they're like, I got to look up that word, let's see what's on YouTube.
I don't know about you, but, you know, I started when I was really young, and it was like, Constitution, what's that? Charisma, what's that? Thaco, what's that? And really, what is that still?
Thaco, yeah.
But yeah, you there's a lot of words that I learned from Dungeons and Dragons, but...
Not entirely useful in everyday life, but still.
Well, no, but it still increases your vocabulary.
But I mean, that was kind of organic and built on, you could say, like a little bit of Frankenstein's monster, but now they've got to pitch to a marketing group. And imagine starting from square one, and they're pitching all these words and using vocabulary that is above an eight-year-old. I'm not saying that they need to write at an eight-year-old level, but, you know, a more intuitive lexicon.
I got the Dragon Age quick start rules, and there's only essentially three classes in that. It's just warrior, rogue, and magic user. So they did just kind of strip back and go back to the original or the kind of iconic things.
What's that like back in the first, like the original D&D and the old retro games? What were the original classes?
Well, the version I had, which was like the black box, it was about like board game size. I think it was like the basic set. There were six classes. You had like cleric, fighter, thief, mage, elf, and dwarf.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I first got it, and I was kind of young, I still thought it was kind of weird that an elf couldn't be a fighter or a dwarf couldn't be
a fighter.
Yeah.
Well, I think the dwarf was like a subclass of fighter.
Well, yeah, I just always thought of,
in the early, really early editions, it was, what, Fighting Man?
Yeah.
Cleric, with Magic User?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Which is weird, because Fighting Man and Magic User, those make a lot of sense, but Cleric was definitely not in my lexicon when I was that age.
Oh, exactly. I mean, so you have to look it up. Mm. What's a cleric? Oh, it's like a priest. Muslim. Oh, what? So what does he do?
Apparently, according to my D&D, he carries a mace and wears chainmail.
I thought he issued fatwas, I thought.
Speaking of retro, they Wizards of the Coast announced that they're actually reprinting the original Dungeon Master's Guide, the Player's Handbook, and...
Monster Manual.
Yeah.
Cool. I remember those. I remember actually going to the library almost on a weekly basis to borrow those.
They actually had them at the library.
Yeah, they did. They kept them behind the desk. They didn't keep them on the regular shelves.
Because they were demonic influence.
Exactly.
Yeah. Did you have to go, I'd like a Playboy and the Player's
Handbook? That's pretty good.
Sandwiched in between some pornography.
Just make it look no more normal.
What are you doing, Chris? You know, just looking at some...
Just looking at some naked women. All right.
Yeah. Actually, that's a naked man. Well, yeah, whatever. that's the way I roll. Is that D&D underneath?
Oh, no.
That's more naked men.
Mom, can you knock first?
You've been in there a long time. Yeah, I know. Yeah. What's that sound here? Clack, 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 clack. Are you rolling a D20?
I'll make it go blind.
I don't know if I'd actually get them, because, yeah, they'll be hardback, but...
It looks like they're going to be hard to get.
I imagine so, because they're going to be, like, limited editions.
Yeah, and they're doing it through hobby centers.
Yeah.
So perhaps somebody like Amazon's not going to carry them.
Oh, I wonder.
They don't have them at the moment, or at least when I checked.
Mm.
I would probably get them. Oh, but I'm a collector.
Mm.
I'm the collector of the group.
Yeah. Well, I'd kind of get them just to see what they... Or what was in them?
No, the first edition.
Well, I know. I didn't mean it like that, but I meant, you know.
Last time you looked.
Fine, funny.
We're reprinting first edition. It's like, I wonder what's inside. Maybe first edition. Huh?
They did call it first edition reprint. All right. Yeah, right.
Smart new covers. Guy. I think that's going to be the only
difference. Yeah, that's the only difference. Yeah. I'm not sure what's on the cover.
No, it's just
they haven't shown it.
Black and white drawings, but obviously those aren't the covers.
No.
Yeah. $35?
Oh, $35. I thought it was about like 45 or something.
Oh, I thought it was 35. Mm-hmm. $34.99. So, do you think that's going to work? Is that like a nice offering? It's part of the proceeds will go to the Gary Gygax Memorial Fund. But do you think is that going to be a nice peace offering for the people that overreacted to 4th edition? Or 3rd edition or 2nd edition? And 2, is that going to kind of take away a bit of the market from the retro clones that are out there?
Not if they don't do mass printing.
Yeah, that's a good point.
If it's a very limited edition, then the people who still play the retro clones, they might not be able to get their hands on one. So
I'd probably say yes on both counts. I could kind of see it as a way to say, yeah, we're kind of sorry for 4th edition or 3rd edition or whatever you said. But I guess Chris brings up a good point. If they're going to be difficult to get, you know, will it take the place of retro clones? Maybe. But I don't know. I get the kind of feeling that Wizards would kind of put out more copies if they do well.
Well, we thought that when Games Workshop released Space Hulk and it sold out.
Mm-hmm. And they didn't. Oh, all right.
As far as I know.
Yeah, so maybe they won't.
That's too bad because the nostalgia factor alone could get a lot of people.
Honestly, I think that's the only thing that's carrying it, the nostalgia factor.
I don't know.
Well, there's a nostalgia factor, so I think it would get people like, let's say myself, who's more than happy to play a 4E or Pathfinder or something like that. But then there's also people with the books that are falling apart. They might buy it to replace it. And perhaps there could be some people, I don't know, there could be some people who play first edition, but they've decided to get Castles and Crusaders because their old D&D rule book is falling apart and they don't want to have a PDF.
Or who knows, might even catch some 4E players. Probably not.
Like people that came in on 4E, I don't see them going to that. I also don't see that book injecting any new blood into the hobby.
No.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because, you know, people are saying we want to capture the excitement that old D&D gave us when it came out. But I don't think old D&D can recapture that magic. I think a new D&D is what you need to recapture that magic. So yeah, it's something for, like nostalgia factor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like a, Battlestar Galactica lunchbox.
A metal one?
Metal. Or plastic. All right, when I grew up, I had the plastic ones.
Yeah, I had plastic ones too. I was just thinking the metal ones, you know.
Brown paper bag. It's at the end of the table.
Reading your D&D book because nobody liked you. Who's that strange kid at the end of the table with that big book? What are the weird little dice he has? I don't know. I'll make fun of him. Yeah, brown paper bag.
You just got the brown paper bags to hide your pornography.
You're right.
Well, he had a lot of them.
You're one of those weird nostalgia guys, and it's just brown paper bags wall to wall. Well, this brown paper bag is from 75. Can you notice the different fold from the 1980 brown paper bags that they came out with? Yes, that looks like somebody drew Buck Rogers on that one. Yeah, that was me.
Actually, that tangent, but that would be a pretty awesome lunchbox. Every day you could have something new.
Yeah, so that's like one of those games where you see how fast you can clean your room and then see if you can beat your time the next time you do it.
Yeah, all right.
Well, speaking of retro clones, that's what we're going to talk about today. Wayne, not recently, but recently looked at it, bought a retro clone called The Secret Fire.
And you have to say it in all capitals.
The Secret Fire!
That's better.
Also known as the Legends and Labyrinths.
Formerly known as, yes.
No.
FKA.
So we've been reading through the rulebook and enjoying it.
yes,
indeed.
Perhaps not the reasons the author intended. So we thought we would discuss The Secret Fire and just retrochrones in general, whether it's a good idea and how innovative these are or can be. So why'd you buy The Secret Fire, right?
I got it from DriveThruRPG, and actually the thing that made me buy it was the cover.
The hairy dragon?
You say that, but it's actually, it doesn't look hairy, it's kind of scaly, right? So I just, it popped up in the window, and I'm like, oh, all right, look at this. And it had a really nice cover art, and I read a description of it, which I tried to find again, but from what I read, it sounded like it was, I guess, a modern kind of interpretation of the old school D&D. And from what I read, it sounded pretty interesting. I've been kind of interested in like the old school Renaissance. just to see kind of what they'd done. And it was only $9.99, marked down from $24.99.
Yeah.
So I figured, what the heck, I'll spend the $10 on it and get it. And I remember downloading it, I opened it up, and you can hear the giggles in the background because I'm at a loss for words. I opened it up.
And the think sound effect was foom.
Like,
I'm just thinking, it's like, and I downloaded it. And it took maybe about 5 minutes to download that. Now, I put it in on my desktop first.
All right. I wasn't going that bad.
Then I moved into a folder. I decided to call the folder The Secret Fire.
In all capitals.
Now, I don't always call the folders exactly what it is. Sometimes it's a mood. How does that make me?
Do you want to hear the story or not?
I've heard it.
And then I debated the left or the right side of the desktop.
Actually, it goes neither on the left or the right. It goes in the My Documents folder under RPG stuff, all right?
Interesting. Now, do you coordinate that for nothing?
It just reminded me when we did the Lovecraft episode, and we started at H.P. Lovecraft's birth.
Where else are you supposed to start a biography?
Of course.
So, what did you think of The Sacred Fire?
I didn't get past the second page. I honestly did not get past the second page, and I said, I can't read this anymore. I must obviously be missing something, and I stopped reading it. And that was this past summer.
Well, obviously, you've picked it up again. We're not going to talk about two pages.
You read the third page.
I read the third page now, and my brain exploded. So I honestly don't know what made me look at it again, other than the fact that I guess it was worth a second chance.
So what'd you think of it?
I'm at a loss for words, is the best way to describe it. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't know. Let's.
We should get into it.
We should rather than try attempt to describe it and my feelings, we should just get in, right into it.
Okay. Well, we break it up. Do the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Right.
So.
I thought it was the pompous.
Well, yeah, yeah. Right.
I thought it was pretty ugly too, but
pompous can be ugly. Though.
All right. Well, so what's the good? What did you like about The Secret Fire?
The only thing I liked about it pretty much was the cover.
Which is odd because I didn't like the cover.
Yeah.
I thought the dragon looked hairy.
The cover's not bad.
Yeah.
No. Sorry, I didn't mind the line drawings. Now,
No!
I don't get turned off by a black and white product. I don't think that's
a selling point.
I don't think it's a selling point anymore. I think the fact that every other game is moved towards color. Mm. If you're going to produce a black and white product, it means you don't have the money. Fair enough. That's fine. Right. A good product can be black and white and sell itself.
Yeah. The hand drawn maps in the back were really nice. I liked them.
Okay. Mm. Yeah. Well, come back to me. I'll think of something.
Yeah.
Well, actually,
you had some good things, Chris.
Yeah, there are a couple things in there that I thought were pretty cool that I liked about it. I liked the alignment traits that you came up with for being good, neutral, or evil. There were different descriptors that you could choose for your character. So, like, for some of the good traits were honesty, and some of the evil traits were for compulsive liar or gambler.
I love that. Compulsive liar.
Role play it. You're a Lyle. You're compulsively Lyle.
Stop. It was actually pretty fun. One guy, one review that I read pointed out that you, in some cases, you're supposed to randomly roll these traits, so you could end up with compulsive honesty and compulsive Lyle. Who knows? So, yeah.
Was that intentional? All right.
I liked that with these traits that you have to take.
Can I stop you there?
Sure.
I don't mind a random roll system, but if a random roll can lead to a contradiction like that, how could you be compulsively honest and a compulsive liar at the same time? Now you could go, hey, role play through it. But then,
yeah,
I mean,
agreed.
You're a pacifist and...
Bloodthirsty.
A bloodthirsty pacifist. Oh, that juxtaposition. It's so rich.
I wanted to kill you, but I can't.
It's an oxymoron, but... Or I just sometimes it could be just dumb. Like, you didn't plan it out. Like, did you not have people, when the playtest, roll randomly and do come up with those two things that are at odds?
Well,
maybe there's re-roll if it's at odds. I didn't find that terribly innovative. Maybe it's something to like about it, sure, but I didn't find that terribly innovative. And we should say, if it sounds like we're being overly harsh when we talk about that it's not innovative or not revolutionary, but a lot of the hyperbole surrounding the game...
Yeah.
From the author, George Strayton, does emphasize that somehow it's this unique,
reimagining.
A unique reimagining of a Dungeons
or reinvention.
And Dragons, yeah. A reinvention of Dungeons and Dragons, but that is both hearkening back to its beginnings, but also completely innovative and cutting edge and something that you've never seen before.
Yeah, if you're going to claim your thing is innovative as often as the author has, then if it's not innovative, you should be able to take that criticism.
Yeah. But so, then you got, maybe that's that oxymoronic approach to the game, you know, like the bloodthirsty pacifist.
What did he do? Roll on his table? I'm going to write this in the style of pompous yet humble. How's that going to work?
We're on the good. We're still on the good.
Yeah, I realized that. Sorry.
I rolled in and went, old school gaming and completely cutting edge gaming. Okay. All right. I think I've got it.
All right. Sorry. Go ahead, Chris.
No, but like, I totally agree. None of the things that I saw in the book were innovative at all.
Like, for example, in the alignment system, if you look at, like, let's say the cockatrice, it's not neutral evil. It's evil neutral. Yeah, wrap your brains around the head.
Yeah, and this whole trait thing, it comes from aspects which they have in the fate system, which I think is a really good thing.
Great. World of Darkness has virtues and vices.
And that's actually something else that I wanted to point out. Is one other thing that I like with the traits is that you have to choose a trait for each of the levels, good, neutral, and evil. So even a good character, that may be his dominant thing, but he still has to choose an, like a flaw.
Like, I know we're on good, but how is that any different from a game that requires or has the options for players to choose flaws for their characters?
Not at all. Again, I'm not trying to say this is new or innovative. I'm just saying this is a part of the game that I like.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Okay.
Yeah. Carry on.
Yeah, carry on. All right, go on.
You may continue. I liked the special effects that he had. And that's where each character has a certain number of energy points, and not all that well named, but energy points you can spend in combat, or I only saw examples of them in combat. I didn't see them in role playing situations, but where you can do special effects. You can maybe describe it as I spend an energy point and drive my sword through his chest, and
for an extra d6 of damage,
exactly.
Right.
Or you can use it to flip over or something so you're in on the backside of your enemy. Or...
And I shove my shoulder into him and knock him prone.
Exactly, things like that. And I thought that's pretty cool. I really like the idea to add extra description, extra flavor to combat, and I think that's a pretty good way of doing it.
You know what? I do too. I like that as well. Since we're still on the like, the fact that it has a mechanic for doing that, okay.
There is a downside to it. I don't like necessarily the way to earn energy points, and that gets into it's when you roleplay the character traits that you've chosen. That kind of gets into what we talked about previously in the Fate episode,
right,
about how you earn Fate points. You guys feel like it's kind of a pat on the head. But
that was Savage Worlds. We thought it was
Savage Worlds as well, yeah. Both of those, I think. Also, I think it's been done... This whole idea has been done better in other games. Fate is an example of one. And another is Exalted. Yeah, you get bonuses for adding description.
Right.
You don't have a pool that you pay to add description. I think it's better to give... It's kind of a more positive spin on
it. You were doing that in the 4E campaign we ran, where if we described something in a cool way, you said that's worth like a +1 bonus.
Absolutely.
Or like a +2 bonus. So
just adding flavor, I think, helps out any game. So, and this is a way that's codified in the rules, so I thought that was good.
Yeah, but I think it's pretty telling that he's using a word like energy points, and the reason's not because it's actually an accurate description of what it is, it's because all the other words have been taken.
Right.
Yeah.
Because there's style points and ubiquity and fate points and
fate.
All these, you know... Yeah. Yeah, so many games have used these mechanics now that it seems like it's, it was perhaps one of the few, I don't know, things that have come up in the last 30 years that he bolted onto the original D&D rules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you couldn't have called them like inner fire points or something to tie into the secret fire motif?
Yeah.
Rather than just energy points?
Secret points.
Secret points.
Secret points.
I don't know.
Fire points, as we said.
Fire points.
Or even just points.
The points.
The points. Sorry, I forgot. It's all capitalized, so it'd be Secret Fire Points!
And then, not to drag on all the way, but the last thing I liked was the wound penalties. The way the game works, it has different levels of wounds for your character. I think it's like grazed and wounded and death's door. But I like that the ones where you're very near the end, I noticed that your critical range, where you can score a critical hit, increases.
Yeah.
So kind of as you get closer to dying, it also gives you kind of a bonus towards doing something really awesome, or maybe turning the fight around.
It does kind of feel heroic.
Because it might not work, but I thought that's a pretty cool idea.
Yeah, looking on paper, yeah, I can see it does kind of lend a heroic feel to it. You know, and you're in a desperate situation, so, you know, you kind of dig deep to reserves.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah. And on the other side of it also had, it increased your fumble range as well. So, yeah.
But, again, while I like the idea, it just wasn't all that innovative, in my opinion. You know?
Do you know something that's from, I couldn't think of another game that I've seen that in before.
He actually said he got it from, he used to work on the Star Wars line for West End Games.
Yeah, West
so
End
he took
Games.
It from West End game style damage. It looked very similar to what World of Darkness does.
Yeah.
Perhaps the addition of you get actually bonuses to be extra heroic. I wouldn't say that's unique, but could have been something that he added to the West End template or the World of Darkness.
Yeah. Did you think of any other things you liked, Lyle? Silence means no.
That was the most negative way of saying it. Anything else you
liked? No, I was genuinely trying to think. No. Not really. Nothing really.
Nothing jumped out at you?
Jumped out at me. It's 312 pages, and I really don't know what the world is. You know, it's just you have to wade through a lot of other text,
yeah,
which has nothing to do with the game, to get to certain rules. I think now we're segging into
bad. Yeah, we're
kind
of segging into bad. So, yeah, slowly moving over to bad. Yeah.
All right, who wants to start?
I think the thing is, like, he sets himself up, and I've seen other reviews where they say, well, you know, some people can react badly to his writing style, and I saw him in an interview, and he is very enthusiastic. But he seems to be presenting, the way he describes a role-playing game, it's like he's describing it as if someone's never heard of a role-playing game before. So, and it's almost as if he's taking credit for all of these concepts. So while Chris is like outlining these good things that he's incorporated into the game, the way he tries to sell it is if he's invented it.
Right.
And he is a screenwriter, and he actually has legitimate screenwriting credits, and he does have some game design credits. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to present himself and the game as a perfect marriage of screenwriting and game design. And I'm not exaggerating at all, because he's actually written that down as screenwriting and game design game.
Several times.
He calls it his immersion mechanics. In the book, and this is one of the problems, you know, it is a 312-page book, and there's a lot that could have been cut from it. His childhood could have been cut from it, because people generally don't buy a gaming book to learn about, you know, someone's Halloween.
Yeah, sorry, could I just interject here and say this book reads like somebody's notes for a game they want to create.
Right. It reads like somebody's diary.
Yes, yes, it does. And that's why I couldn't get past those first two pages when I first started reading it, because I'm like, am I reading somebody's diary about a game he wants to create, or am I reading a finished and polished set of rules here? Because, like, when I showed the PDF to Lyle, what your gag was, you were calling out the page numbers as you were going through them, as kind of like, I haven't gotten any rules yet. And I believe you got up to what, like page 21? You're like, page 21, and still no rules.
Well, because on page 18 and page 19 and page 20, you're subjected to basically my advertising copy, which is, what makes The Secret Fire different from other role-playing or other fantasy RPGs? Number one, role-playing mechanics. Oh, okay. I think every other game has role-playing mechanics. In particular, and I'm summarizing here, the good, neutral, evil trait that Chris said as a good point. And one's ability score comes with an associated descriptor. For example, strength ranges from feeble to mighty. Intellect ranges from moronic to brilliant. And those people who've played Marvel superheroes will recognize, hey, they did that. That's right.
Same in Fate.
Yeah, same in Fate. Fate does that, yeah.
All right. They did that.
Yeah, yeah. I wasn't trying to pull a George Strait and say that Fate did it first. I'm just saying Fate also does that.
Yeah. No, I'm just thinking about that South Park episode where they're going through going, The Simpsons are it.
Yeah, Simpsons already did it. Yeah, Simpsons did it. Yeah.
So you might be wondering, well, how does that work? Well, he actually gives us an example. But he gives us the example in number 5, narrative versus numerical style, as what makes it unique. So I'll just read it. Players use code words that represent numerical values to make the game, especially battle sequences, more immersive. Example 1. Dave shouts out, using my muscular strength, I slash at the goblin with my longsword, Garm's Tooth, landing a serious blow for 10 points of damage. I finish the attack by slamming my shoulder into the goblin's chest, knocking it to the ground. Alright, so we see the example of muscular strength, which is about the equivalent of...
I think it's like a 13 to 15.
Muscular. 13 to 15. Well, I mean, that's, okay, I get it. No, but that's assuming somebody goes, using my 15 strength, I, you know, swing my sword, which I think would be an unusual thing to say in at a gaming table.
I agree. Yeah.
You'd probably just say, I swing my sword.
Yeah.
Now,
because I use my strength as opposed to what, your intelligence to swing your sword?
Yeah, also, so Mighty is one of the descriptors, so I use my mighty strength. I could actually see somebody saying that. Mm. I mean, it wouldn't be in a well-written novel, but you could actually see it in a novel.
Perhaps one of those, like, paperback romance things you find at the checkout aisle?
I guess so. I use my mighty strength to sweep her off
her feet.
To remove her clothes. She protests, I don't care. I have mighty strength.
I use my poor perception
to ignore those, to misinterpret those no's.
She uses her, what, charming charisma to try and get to not do it, but no.
Oh, those don't work. She uses her nails then.
But her strength is feeble, so I am unaffected.
Okay, I like the system.
Oh, rape's so funny. Sorry. But muscular strength, who would say I use my muscular strength? So even though you have a code word, you're kind of forcing. Oh, and what if the person does have feeble strength, but they want to say, using my feeble strength.
I strike at him.
Yeah. Using my moronic intellect, which is actual code word from the game. I tried to, obviously I failed doing this. So.
Oh, one of the ones for charisma? Repulsive.
Using my repulsive charisma.
I attempt to seduce the young bar wench. You fail miserably.
You brush beer off your face. But then it's even funny, like, even
Wait, sorry.
Yeah, go
Despite
ahead.
Her feeble strength, she lands a solid blow across your face for 5 points of damage.
I just love how you just chuckle to yourself.
I thought it was funny.
I'd kill me.
But this is the example he's using to illustrate that his game is a narrative versus not a numerical
and
style.
And immersive.
Yeah, immersive, but... See if you can spot the thing that doesn't belong, or maybe it does. Landing a serious blow for 10 points of strength.
Oh, 10 points of damage.
Oh, 10 points of damage. So I guess the code word for 10 together is 10. The code word for a little circle with another little circle on top, the code word we're going to use for that is 8.
Wait, I have to write that down. Hold on.
The code for a backwards 2 is 5.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the weird thing is, so like it's there.
Yeah.
Yet in the section with monsters, it lists the damage they do. I'm pretty sure it lists the damage they do with those descriptor words.
Oh, so it does like a serious blow or something like that?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Or it says like players have to make, I forget the descriptor he uses, but basically they're saying they have to make a luck check at whatever, like +5 or something, and he uses a descriptor for that. And unless you remember what the descriptors correspond to, it would be pretty hard to actually do it.
Okay, but let's imagine you've bought into it, all right, this code words. Okay, oh. Damage doesn't have a code word.
It actually does sound kind of cool.
Nah, I disagree.
Okay.
But go on, Lyle.
Right, but you've bought into it, let's say, and you think, well, that's fantastic, because I'm always saying I use my 3 strength to swing my sword, so using my feeble strength
does sound
a little bit better. And yeah, I guess if you do say using my 15 strength or my 18 strength, using my mighty strength would sound a little bit better. But see if you can spot the gap here. So the descriptors for strength, starting at 3, feeble, 4 to 5, wimpy, 12, dash. 13 to 15, muscular.
I tried so hard not to laugh and interrupt you.
So you went, whoa, what's missing there? Oh, instead of an actual descriptor for the 9 to 12, which I guess would be
you would get
average,
most often.
Yeah. Oh, average. I think we just found the descriptor you could use.
Using my not applicable strength.
Yeah, so how would you use it? Using my dash strength or my
I believe
blank
you supposed to say using my strength. I'm sorry, what did you say? You know, using my strength.
And, I mean, this is... Well, it's laughable, and it's one of the reasons why we wanted to talk about this game.
It's one of the reasons I laughed so hard just then.
But then you actually use, and this is actually, maybe I should have put this in the good, when you design a city, and designing a city, especially for a new game master, in The Secret Fire, a game master is called the master creator, the MC, because you're the MC of the night.
You.
Yeah. Yo, what's up?
Actually, you know what? I've talked about Apocalypse World before, and in that one, you're actually Master of Ceremonies, MC, which makes a little bit more sense, in my opinion.
Well, that's what an MC is.
Yeah.
But Master Creator. So creating a world can be a little bit intimidating. Mm. So he says, well, you could actually assign like your character stats to a city.
Yeah.
So what that would mean is your city has a strength, your city has a an agility. Your city is an intellect. And these correspond to certain things. Your strength would be the city's defense. The intellect would be the city's magic. The presence is the city's architecture. So even in his own examples, we have a city with defenses unassailable. Oh, okay, that sounds pretty hard. Magic and learning, unlearned. All right, so kind of a primitive.
I'm sensing a well-defended yet
primitive,
barbaric city.
Yeah, barbaric city. All right, that's good. The religion, holy. All right, so a lot of shamans, perhaps. Yeah, that's coming together, you know. Yeah. So as a new mass creator, this is coming quite easy to make my city.
I like how it's shaping up, yeah.
Yeah. Size and population, non-applicable.
So wait a minute. There are no people there?
And it's not applicable because the rating is 12, and they have no descriptors. 9 to 12, no descriptor. All right, okay. So nobody lives there. The economy, opulent. All right.
So they're very rich non-people.
And the architecture, non-applicable.
So there's no buildings either.
Well, it makes sense if you have no people.
Yeah, it's unassailable because there's nothing to assail.
It's a desert plain.
I said the same thing. It's like a walled... No, it's not even walled because there's no architecture.
You tried to say wall, but then I was like, no architecture, dude.
It's a high plateau rounded by like sheer mountains with gold coins scattered across everywhere, and that's it. Yet a holy aura pervades the entire area.
Right. I mean, this is not to say that descriptors is a bad thing. It's just, I think it gets it, one of the core problems with the book is that it wasn't well designed properly edited, where an editor might spot, you know, this is actually funny, or somebody...
And not in a good way. In addition to the writing style, it's put together quite sloppily.
Just so the audience knows that there, Lyle is an editor and Wayne is a designer.
Well, so are you.
Yes.
And I'm surprised you were able to read through it, because that definitely goes in my bad book.
Mm-hmm.
Or my bad list. Like, even though the book is about the size of an average paperback.
Yeah.
It's one column of text that mm-hmm. just goes from left to right, which...
It's hard to read,
especially when, like, sentences are interspersed with what is essentially his resume and credentials when you're trying to read rules.
Anybody who's laying out your own game books out there, use columns, please.
Two columns, please. At least.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, an editor could have then said either like highlighted that and circled in red and said, "Okay, that
doesn't work."
Stupid.
Yeah,
because you have descriptors. Because also for the new game master, what does 15 defenses mean to them? Probably not a lot, but unassailable means something.
Yeah, so it makes sense.
That's
yeah.
selling the descriptor. But what does non-applicable mean to them? It means it doesn't exist. It doesn't apply. The size and population doesn't apply to the city, which would imply that it's not a city.
Empty, yeah.
So, I mean, or just a playtester or anybody would say, "Hey, George, I want you just to listen. Doesn't that sound strange to you?" And he goes, "Well, what would you put?" I'm like, "Well, if I was desperate for a descriptor, perhaps I would put average."
You know, can I just say,
because then you would have an average population's, I guess, size. And at least somebody could kind of understand. They might ask the question, "Sorry, I know, you know, there's an average city size in the modern world and there's an average city size in the fantasy world, but that would be nice, of course. But at least it's something. At least it's not non-applicable."
The weird thing is, watching one of the playtest videos, he asks a player, "Okay, what's your strength?" Because the player tried to do something strength-related, and the guy says, "Oh, it's an 11. And George actually says, "So your strength is average," while running the game. So why wouldn't you have that as a descriptor when he himself said that while he was running the game?
Yeah, the player said, "No, it's a dash."
Well, no, because
but no, that's what's
I wrote it. I wrote it, so I know what the rules say.
No, well, why don't you write it in the rules? So that's another thing that makes it so innovative.
So one of the other things he kind of I guess touts as being innovative, or what makes the Secret Fire different from other fantasy role playing games, is its sandbox style. This is point number 6, and to him, sandbox style, in other words, not nicely balanced for your party. So it says parties may encounter easy obstacles they can overcome in seconds, or impossible tasks that will decimate the group. Okay. Players must learn to recognize the differences between the two and employ other strategies, including parlay and its ignoble cousin flight, before jumping into battle. Note that vast amounts of experience points earned by PCs arise from winning treasure and accompanying quests, with little gain for defeating or successfully parlaying with monsters. Like, I see where he's going with it. He's kind of saying that a lot of RPGs now focus on monster killing. and that's how you get experience points in advance. And, okay, you want the world to kind of be realistic and not every encounter is going to be balanced, but then when you actually read the section, it comes off as being very, I don't know, aggressive, or it seems like you're playing an adversary DM.
Yeah. No.
Which from what I understand is kind of the feel that those old school games had. They were kind of very much player versus DM. But like, if you're so innovative and if you've been following the RPG hobby for the past 30 years, wouldn't you kind of see that that's not really what RPGs are now?
Well, there's something to be said for that. There's the more modern versions of D&D, 4E especially, and going back to 3.5, there comes that kind of scalability. I think it's the first time I've heard sandbox used to describe the lack of balance between
right.
party strength and
because
the
encounters. It's not an accurate description.
Yeah.
Right.
But he does give kind of an accurate description of sandbox elsewhere in the rulebook, where he says players can go anywhere.
Yeah. Right.
When you actually read the sample adventure he provides at the end, you find out, no, they can't.
Yeah. They can go anywhere they want within the dungeon I've made for them.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you can't even go anywhere in that dungeon because there is a statue. Mm-hmm. And it requires you find these five elements. Not to spoil this adventure for anybody.
Because, frankly, who will run it?
Yeah, I'm sorry. But you're supposed to find, there's five hands, there's five elements. But you can't get the fifth element. So, in other words, you can't get past this statue until you do X.
Right.
And X is done in what he describes as the second session. Mm-hmm. Now, that could be a typo. I mean, because there's several in the book. But you've actually mapped out or planned out game time.
Yeah.
And saying that they can't get past this statue no matter what they do until the second session. So that's not a sandbox game. That's a very railroad game. And when you listen to him in interviews, when you listen to the
playtest,
what he says in the book, then you say that he doesn't want a railroad, but then he railroads. And I think that's something that, and the reason why, we're not trying to have a mean-spirited episode here, but what we're seeing is somebody who's saying one thing and delivering another.
Yeah, exactly.
And he is so enthusiastic that you might believe what he says and think.
I mean, I bought it.
Well, yeah, you did buy it.
Well, apparently.
And mighty grateful we are. Yeah.
apparently I'm just a gullible idiot for buying it.
That's 10 bucks you ever spent.
Yes. Yeah. That's 10 bucks I've never spent.
Yeah, exactly. So. I'm not quite up to the 10 bucks thing. I'm about like $5 worth of enjoyment out of it.
Yeah.
But anyway, sorry, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, but getting back to that before, like having this where the encounters are balanced to the party, that's I think that's more of a game issue. Some game masters want to play a game where it's about the combat, and that's the players want to go up against something that they have a chance of beating. But I've also played in other games where it's the world is realistic. If you go against a dragon at first level, you're going to die.
When third edition came out of Dungeons and Dragons, the first module that they released for that does have an encounter that's above the party.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but that was like their introduction module, and it's a good module.
But that scenario was designed where you could run away.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas looking at the sample dungeon he has in the back, and that's pretty much all you can create with this book. Like, there's I don't know what I would call it, but in the scenario creation section, it's all about creating dungeons, and there's a little line that says, you know, and here's how to create things outside of a dungeon, but we'll get to that in later books. And that really offended me, because why...
And he says that a lot,
yeah.
Like, oh, but we're not... Well, we'll address this later.
Yeah, in another book coming out soon. Why even put that, right? Why not just say it's beyond the scope of this book to deal with that? But anyway, back to the point about dungeon thing. In that sample dungeon, as Lyle said, it's very railroady. And that seems to be the way he would play, like...
Sorry, can I...
Yeah.
Can I interrupt?
You found the section, yeah.
I actually found one of the sections, so... I'd rather his own words do the talking,
yeah.
So to speak. And this is talking about, you as a master creator must provide the players with these challenges. If you succeed, great reward will be yours. If you fail, you will learn from your mistakes and try again.
Or die. Sorry.
This book will not, however, discuss overall campaign construction. For that, you must wait until our second release, The Secret Fire Supplement 1, Demons and Druids. Coming in December 2011.
It's January 2012.
And it's not out.
Oh, well. I mean, that happens. And I mean, really, if you saw how much the lack of proofing in this product, you say, take 6 more months. You know, read it again. There you'll begin to uncover more of the overall hidden puzzle pieces that undergird the secret fire together as a whole. though you should probably at least make an attempt to begin your search within the book you now hold in your hands, whether in print or digital form, which reveals some of the game's underpinnings, if you can find them. That's one long sentence, sorry. Punctuation helps you breathe. I worked briefly with Damon Lindelof, showrunner of Lost, on the Star Trek film to work out the backstory and learned a great deal about weaving the mysteries into the storylines. In The Secret Fire, we've gone beyond that. But I won't explain how. That will only ruin the fun. So, what was the point of that? He's saying, we're not going to do it. Plug the product. Okay. Right. Usually people put that in the back of the book where you can turn and go, upcoming products.
Right, right. Which this book has.
Then he's got a name drop, which he does, I mean...
All the time.
All the time. This guy, the showrunner for Lost.
Showrunner. What a showrunner.
Showrunner. It's kind of like a producer. So that they kind of design what the whole like story arc and the direction of the show. So he worked briefly with this guy, and he learned some things. But then he only sets that up to tell you he's not going to tell you those things, because that would ruin the fun. Now, if I was going to try to edit down from 212 pages... 312 pages. Here's my first cut. Actually, this is on page 181, so...
Might have been a cut or two before that.
Yeah, this is probably my 181st cut. Yeah.
I noticed that. I think it was on the second or third page where it says one of the three main rules of this game. It's like, have fun and rulings over rules and things like that. And that line really got me. Rulings over rules, yet we have 300 pages of rules.
Yeah.
I thought that was a little bit excessive.
Well, you don't have 300 pages of rules. You have about 200 pages of him talking about himself.
Honestly, I think you have about 50 pages of rules. And most of the bulk of those would be spells.
One of the things that I thought was a little bit odd about it, well, not odd per se, because it goes into the retro gaming thing, is the rolling of stats and the amount of randomization. You can randomly generate pretty much everything in this game, from the dungeon you're playing into your stats to your even your personality,
right,
which I thought was a little odd too. But I think that's something that kind of modern games have evolved past.
Right.
It's you get a chance to create the character how you want, especially when it gets into personality. Games like Traveller, sure, you roll up a random backstory, but you still choose.
You still have choice,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, how...
And I don't think you choose personality.
It can be randomly rolled. I thought that was one of the odder quotes in the game. He said near the beginning that characterization and immersive role-playing is essential to this game, but I noticed in the character creation, it was like step 4. Optional. PC history, goals, and motivation.
Yeah, yeah.
Right on the...
It's kind of... Yeah, contradictory, right? Yeah. Like, I can see all those tables for idea generators or scenario generators, or if a player stuck, here, roll on this to give you an idea.
We got no time to plan, surely roll half a dozen dice, and bam, we got a dungeon to run through tonight.
And, you know, that's fine, but that didn't seem to be the kind of product he was putting together. I mean, there's a section called, like, scenario design, so it kind of implies that you're supposed to put together a story. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, why have all these random tables? Like, there's a section on like dungeon kind of design, and you just kind of like randomly roll for rooms and what's in them. And
but then again, that is part of the spirit of a retro clone. I mean, charts upon charts upon charts, that's how a lot of the old systems were, so that's forgivable.
Yeah, that's right, but they're lazy charts. I mean, you roll traps and there's like on a d10 and four of them are pits.
Just with different depths, right?
There's two different depths, and it's with or without spikes,
right? Ooh.
And he has what he calls mood cues, and you roll for things like lava. First, you roll to see how many mood cues are in this area.
Like 1 in 3.
And then three of the mood cues are different spiders. Then we have beetles and scarabs. That's two different things.
Yeah, two separate ones. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for that.
Don't forget the deadly tarantulas.
Yeah, that's deadly spiders. So there's three different types of spiders. Then you have things like comic element.
Does that mean you find like
element? Anyway.
Comic element? I'm imagining an issue of Superman in the middle of the dungeon.
No, it's not that. It's even funnier than that, Wayne. Note that reads Nixon for president. Dagger to a table in a medieval setting. Oh, okay. Major NPC caught sitting in a latrine, etc. Now, if you're rolling three of these, one of them is ticking clock, one of them is comedic element, and the other is lava. I mean, it just kind of seems a bit silly. I don't know.
They did say comedic element, lava.
Yeah,
the whole sitting on a latrine, singing into the lava.
Yeah. Yeah.
The clock is ticking.
Yeah. It's just really weird.
But it's...
It's hard to describe, isn't it?
You know, I mean, given license to do whatever they want, and they've been homebrewing this game, and they said, oh, whatever, put it all together in a page. Or, sorry, I wish it was on one page. Sorry, put it together in one book, and, you know, that's it, we'll publish it. But, yeah. The guy's living the dream, but should people actually pay for his dream?
You can see that this is truly a labor of love, but it's not a well-polished labor.
Yeah, I believe I likened him to like the George Lucas of RPGs, you know?
But without the actual original trilogy.
Without the
original. American Graffiti.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so he doesn't have any that really to fall back on.
He's got that one episode of Hercules he wrote.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like he has all these credentials, so he must have worked on stuff, and he had all these, like, game credentials, but...
I have one of the things, one of the 3.5 Splat books that he has a writing credit on, cover writing credit.
Yeah. And you look at that, and you said, wow, this guy obviously had editors, creative directors, and all these people above him to keep him on track and to cut his stuff down. And when you take all that away, look what you get.
Yeah, but anybody can do that, you know? Like, I can name drop. I've played with Ernie Gygax before. Yeah. Go me.
Why aren't you writing a book, a 312-page book? Dude, I would pay $9.99 to read your book. Wish I had that $9.99 back.
I would pay the $9.99 that I gave George.
Exactly.
But you had something, speaking of spells, both of you brought up about something, I would say, different about his spells.
Oh, this was definitely different. This was definitely different. So I'm like, okay, I'm flicking through the spell section, and I read that the duration of spells is the real-time duration. Not in the game world.
Yep, he makes that clear.
He makes that very clear. I believe he says, if you cast a spell at 12:08 Eastern Standard Time, then it lasts until 1:08 Eastern Standard Time.
And if George, if you're listening, if you want to know more you could cut, probably could have done without the Eastern Standard Time.
Yeah. So it's different, but in my opinion, that's completely ridiculous. Because 1 hour of real time could be anywhere from a 6-second combat round to a year of game time.
Did you perchance notice any of the durations on the spells? I didn't.
Some of them lasted an hour.
I'm wondering, were there any that were longer than that? Like in the game world, there are ones that last a month.
Some of them say like an hour per level.
So I guess you go home and you set up a firewall going.
Yeah, it's like, no, we gotta keep playing because I said...
Yeah, who's gonna play for 10 hours?
Hey, are we getting pizza? No, we're getting pizza when the firewall is down.
Oh man, that's like 9.5 hours from now. That's just really abusable. You know, like, the player could speed stuff along and just run through everything so that the hour is the entire dungeon, or the GM could turtle and spend an hour describing an empty room and the cobwebs you find in it to burn out your spell. So it's different, but it's definitely not different in a good way.
Yeah, I could see it only being applicable if you were playing real time as well.
Like a LARP.
Yes.
But I suppose that he wants the game to be immersive, so I don't know.
Yeah. So I guess that covers the bad. Now we can get on to the last part, the ugly.
The pompous
in this case, yeah.
But unfortunately, I've got to go catch my last train, so I give that pleasure to you guys.
All right, thanks.
Man, that's quite a pleasure. Yeah.
And don't go too long.
And now the pompous, and maybe, you know, this is perhaps our most mean-spirited episode that we've done.
Yeah, probably.
But I think it's because it just, some of the stuff has been, if it's a retro clone, say it's a retro clone.
Yeah, if you're going to spend, like 18 or so pages talking about how innovative... the product is, and how you've taken, you know, the innovations in the last 30 years of gaming, and your product is so unique, then you better deliver, and it better live up to the hype you're giving it. And if it doesn't, then you kind of deserve what's coming to you.
Right. So, for example, page 20. Like, we still haven't gotten into what the secret fire world is or any of the rules. This is still part of the selling how unique the game is. And it's number 10, Gygax's vision for the future. As Gail Gygax has mentioned on her Facebook page, a screenwriter, myself, is currently developing a film script based on Mr. Gygax's life, using unpublished works, diaries, and notebooks, filled with everything from his earliest thoughts about creating RPGs to the musing of his last days on this earth. The film is yet to be officially announced. The particulars of the storyline, actors, directors, studio, production company, and so forth, I have at his command, via these materials, Mr. Gygax's innermost thoughts on many things, especially his vision for the future of gaming, a vision that mirrors my own. Okay, why do we need to know that you're writing a story about Gary Gygax? Or writing a movie?
Yeah.
Why do you have to tell us that the film has not yet officially been announced, and then list, like, just about everything...
It takes to make a movie?
Movie. I guess has never been announced or agreed to. So, but I mean, that's just like taking up space. Mm. And like, he's trying to say that this game is going to be great. And I've actually seen this in some reviews where people are saying, oh, it seems to be very easy for a new person or young person to understand.
Reviews said that?
Yeah, I saw it in a review.
Wow.
But how? How is wading through like I can 20-something pages of this guy's life and this guy's like selling product. The book that you haven't... Like, if you're looking at the book, you said, well, look, dude, I already bought it. Yeah. But what he's done is he's copied the stuff that's on his website trying to sell the product...
into the book.
And filled up a few more pages of the book.
Yeah, like, I'm a systems guy. I like reading through rules, and what I don't want to read through is, like, a resume and all this stuff. Like I said, after two pages of reading it, I put it down and then said, is this a game? Or is this, like, a diary or notes on a game?
Yeah, and in case you forget that he's a screenwriter.
And no Sam Raimi.
And no Sam Raimi. And some other people, which we'll mention right now, he reminds you again when he talks about the secret fire approach. So, with 15 years of experience as a screenwriter, an MFA in screenwriting from Columbia University, and more than 10 years as a protege of the top screenwriting producing team in Hollywood, Kurtzman Orki, who wrote and produced Transformers, Star Trek, Cowboys and Aliens, and many more films and TV series, including Alias and Fringe, I have learned a thing or two about imbuing emotion into movies and television shows. What, Transformers?
Well, Transformers was an emotional roller coaster.
The same techniques can now be applied almost directly to role-playing games. In fact, one may consider this the, quote, cinematic, end quote, or, quote, literary, end quote, approach to game design. For example, we generate all of the story elements of this game, description of the monsters, for example, before giving any thought to their associated statistics.
I don't think he realizes what story elements mean, because he talks about, like, all the secrets and the things that are available to find in this book and how they're sort of, like, underlying meta plot to this world of the secret fire, and I haven't found it. There doesn't seem to be much, if any, story in here because, like we said before, all those random charts he has in there. There's no, like, the one chapter on the world consists of about 15 or 20 one-paragraph-long blurbs of the countries in this world, which are all pretty standard fantasy fare. There's pretty much nothing, at least in the setting, which is very scant, that's original or innovative or makes this stand out from any other fantasy role-playing game setting. There's probably less setting in here than in other books.
Speaking of other books, I mean, when you read the website, one thing they promise is that they're not going to produce splat book after splat book. I mean, it's funny because one of the legitimate game writing credits that he has is Frostburn, which is very much a
splat book, yeah.
Splat book is back when probably 3.5 was hitting that saturation point. Mm. I'm not saying it's a bad book. I'm just saying it is very much the epitome of a splat book. But then in the first book that he produces, which is supposed to be a standalone book, he keeps saying, like, no, we didn't give you everything because
it's going to come in book two.
Come in book two. And it's not even a supplement. It's supplement number one. So they're already planning. And that's fine to have a series of splat books because that's how role-playing games make money. But don't then say that that's not what you're going to do.
Right.
I believe it gets back to you promise one thing, but you
right, you're given another. Yeah, he actually said, I want, like, this book. All you need to run games are, like, this book, and you can use this one book with all the previous role-playing game books that you've purchased, and isn't that great? And this is all you'll need to have years of entertainment. Well, if that's the case, why are you putting out another splat book?
But, and I'd be fine with that, but then don't put constant reminders in the main book that you don't have everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, as we said before, he said that that's one of the things they did when they designed the game, is they came up with the story elements first, including the monsters.
Yeah. And we said they came up with, they didn't do numbers first.
Right, but who does that? Who comes up with numbers for a monster? Who says, we're going to make a 15-strength monster?
Which I believe in this one would be Mighty Strength.
A Mighty Strength monster. What's it called? I don't know.
But it has Mighty Strength.
Right.
That's all we need to know.
We're talking about monsters like giants and a cockatrice, but that's where dragon, you know. You're going to stumble upon dragon? No, you would say, okay, let's make a dragon for our game. All right, so what are the dragons in our game? Are they kind of the Asian style or the European style? All right, we've got it. More dinosaur, intelligent, non-intelligent, before they stat it out. But he's presenting it as he's just...
Look how innovative we are that we did this first. We came up with the story elements first, and then we put the numbers on it. And as Lyle said, who doesn't do that?
But you had a problem with how he does monsters, Wayne?
Yeah, it wasn't so much that I had a problem with how the monsters were presented. I'll just skip to the one of them here. So this is Cockatrice. Role-playing notes. When portraying the cockatrice for your players, make bird-like movements and rooster sounds when the creature attacks PCs. Add intermittent hissing sounds. Why do I need to know that? Is the cockatrice a monster that's only available in your setting, and so it's so unique that you want to tell people how to role-play it when you're the MC? No, the cockatrice is standard fantasy fare. It's pretty generic, so why do you need to tell people what they should do when they're portraying it in their game? Shouldn't they portray the cockatrice however they want to do it? And that's not the only time he does it. It just comes off as being incredibly patronizing.
I don't know if I have a problem with that.
Okay.
If, and here's the thing, I think part of it is you open the book, we've got to learn about how he discovered D&D, and it's not in a paragraph like my brother introduced me to D&D.
I know, it's a couple pages.
Which is the story. His brother introduced him to D&D on Halloween. If you can react very badly to his writing style and the fact that he name drops, you know, Sam Raimi.
Constantly.
And talks about his experiences, like 15 years as a screenwriter. And that's fantastic, you know.
But shouldn't that be on a separate page?
Yeah, shouldn't that just be on your bio? You know, just at the front of the book.
And last time we checked, an RPG rules manual was not your bio.
And it puts a bad taste in your mouth. So when you get to something like what he does for the cockatrice or the...
It's refreshing?
The purple worm. No, it's just because you've had to wade through so much of the other stuff that you're going to you can react negatively to it, when it could just be like a nice suggestion is, hey, what, you know, to make it more fun for the players at the table, why don't you kind of act it out a bit?
I think what I take issue is the authoritative tone it's kind of written in. It isn't a role-playing notes, so I guess it implies that it's suggestions, but I've seen other ones that say, like, role-playing hints, or role-playing, which I guess leaves a better taste in my mouth than role-playing notes. So I think that's why it comes off as a copy of somebody's rule book that they have literally written notes in for them. Hmm. And now they're sharing them with you.
And I think there's been some innovations in role-playing where layout can really help with stuff like that. For whatever problems people have with the 4E, the actual Dungeon Master's Guide is laid out pretty well and very clear. When there's a little anecdote that a writer wants to share, it's in a separate box.
Right.
So you know that it's you don't need to read that to get the rules, but it might be helpful.
Hmm.
And same with these role-playing notes or hints or whatever. Perhaps a little box could have helped that. This is sounding very, very silly. Certainly cut out all the bio stuff out of the rules, because I don't think that adds to the enthusiasm.
It doesn't. It detracts.
Don't add all the plugs to the supplement, the upcoming supplement. Again, it doesn't add to the immersive experience.
If you're touting your role, your experience as being so immersive, you haven't even written it in an immersive style.
Right. And that is a good point. We're not trying to immerse ourselves into his life and his experience.
Reading The Secret Fire, you would think that was his goal.
Right. But he does fail in that regard, and he doesn't immerse yourself in this actual game world or even a fantasy world, because he keeps breaking the fourth wall. You kind of break away from the mood you're trying to establish to remind the reader that, you know, you've met Sam Raimi or Kurtzman or Lindelhoff. All right, well, we had hoped to do a broader episode on retro clones, so good thing we're not charging you $10 for this episode, and it's free. I think we got maybe a little bit carried away for The Secret Fire, perhaps a little bit mean-spirited, but... No, I take that back. I don't think we were trying to be mean-spirited, but perhaps it came across as a bit...
harsh.
A bit harsh. That's a better word. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's a good descriptor of my feeling.
So, harsh would be what? Let's see. Does that mean I have, like, a -3 charisma?
Something like that. So if you could summarize, like, just what do you think of The Secret Fire?
Honestly, a retro clone.
Okay.
Even though he says it's not, that's what it is.
Yeah. I'd agree with that. And I think there's better retro clones out there. I think my major problem with it was that he's trying to immerse himself into this game. And even though I've read a lot of the most of the rule book. I still don't know what the Secret Fire world setting is, but I know all about his screenwriting.
Right.
I know the people that he's met.
What he's learned from them.
Yeah, what he's learned from them. I know what shows that they did and produced, not necessarily what shows he did.
Right. So you know more about him.
Yes.
Than the world of the book that you've read.
Right, and a lot of books will have that. They'll have a little brief bio. Sometimes it's irrelevant because it doesn't matter who the person is. Sometimes it is relevant when you read about mysteries and you find out that it's a very experienced defense attorney who wrote that book for GURPS. But even that was only about a paragraph.
Mm.
And that's at the beginning. Once you get into the rules, the author doesn't drop her connections and which judges she's met and what lawyers she's worked with. But he seems to have tainted his own product by doing that. And he's a classic example who, on one hand, it's very inspiring because he's very enthusiastic and he obviously loves the game.
And the hobby.
And yeah, he does have some experience. But he needed somebody to edit his, as you said, he needed somebody else to edit his work and say, take out all the stuff.
Yeah.
Every time you mention yourself, take that out.
Yeah.
Every time you mention this other supplement and all the stuff that you aren't offering them,
take that out.
And then a lot of the stuff that he does do, I mean, you might be able to overlook the fact that he has descriptors for everything except for the average descriptor.
Which you'll get most often.
Or that he provides role-playing notes for the monsters, and you might take that in the spirit that is probably intended, is somehow to just immerse the players more into the setting. Well, it's good to see the spirit of old D&D is still alive. I'd like to see it more alive in other games.
Yeah, good one.
All right, well, apologies for the rant. Next episode, we'll be back to talking about things that we love. So hopefully we'll have a
more positive
spirit.
Yeah. So thank you for joining us on Idle Red Hands. You can check us out on the website, www.idleredhands.com. That's idleredhands.com. Can't do it as fast as Chris. You can check us out on the website, DriveThruRPG, Stitcher, iTunes, post on our forums, leave a comment on the episodes, write us an email.
Thank you, Alpha Dean.
Yep. And, we'd love to hear from you. So, thanks very much, and see you next time.
Bye.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Oh,
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.